Hi everyone, it's Tom here. In just a moment, we're going to get into this episode of Last Orders. Sorry, it's a little bit late this month. I think you can already guess what it will all be about. What a crazy few weeks it's been. I hope everyone out there is staying safe and well. We at Spiked, we're among the lucky ones. We can more or less carry on doing what we do remotely despite the lockdown. I know many people who've been in touch who can't. So we're going to do our best to keep bringing you comment and analysis uninterrupted. If you'd like to and can afford to help support us through this period, that of course is hugely appreciated given all that's going on. And as ever, the best way to do so is to become a regular donor. Even £5 per month can really be a huge help. And if you'd like to sign up, you can do that at spiked-online.com and clicking on the donate button as ever. Otherwise, be sure to keep reading Spiked every day. We'll continue discussing all the issues around the coronavirus crisis and hopefully more and more non-coronavirus issues and stories as well. Because it has become a bit relentless at the moment. So thanks so much. Stay well, stay safe. And now on with Last Orders. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. My name's Tom Slater, and this is the show where myself and Chris Snowden usually discuss all the latest news and liberalism and censorship in the nanny state with the help of an invited guest. This month, however, we're only really talking about one thing, the coronavirus crisis. With the help of Claire Fox, director of the Academy of Ideas, we try to get to grips with where we're at and where we might be headed. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor of Spiked, and today, as ever, I'm joined down the line this time by the IEA's Director of Lifestyle Economics, Chris Snowden. Hello, Chris. Hope you're well.
Hello, Tom. Hope you're well.
And we're also delighted to be joined today, also down the line, of course, by Claire Fox, Director of the Academy of Ideas. Thanks, Claire, for coming back on the show.
It's great to be back.
So it's a strange time in which to be doing a sort of libertarian-leaning podcast. Britain's on lockdown amid the coronavirus crisis. You know, British society has changed almost beyond recognition since last time we did an episode of this. Coronavirus dominating everything, of course. And as a result, today, as many people will probably have guessed by now, we're only really going to be talking about that one thing. But there is so much to talk about. The development of it so far, the responses to it, the shadow this might all cast on society in the future. But Chris, to kick things off, I just want to get your thoughts on where we're at. You know, we spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about the kind of nonsense nanny state panics that pass themselves off as public health crises. What are your thoughts as we're facing this, you know, very real public health crisis?
That it is a real crisis and it is a real public health issue, and the stuff we normally talk about isn't. And so different rules apply, and you can tolerate a greater degree of government coercion because basically John Stuart Mill's harm principle, you know, people who have this disease are a threat to others. And so the government needs to do more about that than they do about the amount of sugar in biscuits, which is Public Health England's, you know, major crusade the last couple of years. The limits of what the government should do in this particular case, I think it's really hard to say. I've tended to kind of trust the experts on this, I have to say. I think that the guys who wrote the Imperial College paper on this and the modelling, I can't, you know, gainsay them. It seems reasonable. They seem plausible people. The chief medical officer, I think, has come out of this quite well. These guys, I've seen them in a couple of press conferences, and they're pretty impressive people. They seem to be quite level-headed. And they've had a plan from day one, and despite all this talk about U-turns and so on, the government has basically followed it. It hasn't been a U-turn at all. It's been an acceleration in exactly the same direction, the very opposite of a U-turn. Whether they're right or not, I guess time will tell. But I can't go along with the idea that we should just let it, and let nature take its course and save the economy. The economy is going to be in a horrendous state by the end of this. But I don't think you can risk having God knows how many people, you know, dying on hospital floors, which seems a realistic outcome, if it spreads as we think it does. And it does seem incredibly infectious, even if it only kills a relatively small number of cases.
Claire, what have you made of the response from the British government so far, I guess, to start off with?
Well, I think the important point that Chris has made, I might not go quite as far as him, but one important point that you've made, which obviously Matt Ridley has also made very forcefully, is that, you know, one of the problems about crying wolf is that when a real wolf arrives, you don't recognize them. And as everything's been a pandemic and an epidemic over the last 10 years in the nanny state sense, you know, epidemics of obesity and so on and so forth, and kind of great catastrophizing language. When then something like a real pandemic comes along and that same catastrophizing language is used, it's disorientating, to say the least, because you're just not sure. And obviously, at the same time, the government's use of experts and scientists and medical experts and nudges and public health experts, you know, for somebody like myself and probably yourselves in some ways, a lot of the expert advice that we've received over the years and the way politicians have hidden behind that, the evidence shows, also makes one at least pause and have some scepticism. So I pause and have some scepticism. But I also, like Chris, think that I'm going along with the lockdown. I'm not, I suppose, completely convinced though, Chris, and this is to say to both of you, that all of this has been driven just by the expertise. I mean, some of it shouldn't be, because there are political finer points of morals and judgment to be made. But it's also the case that, say, for example, this lockdown that we're in at the moment, you know, that was very much, you know, one day, literally the day before. I don't think it's a U-turn, but I think the clamour for more to be done that comes from the political sources of particularly lobby journalists and a certain fear and panic in the population, which is perfectly understandable, means that there is a danger, I think, of some things happening that hide behind the science when, in fact, the timing at least doesn't necessarily get straightforwardly indicated by the evidence and the science. The other thing is that I think that the experts, that the chief medical officer and the chief scientific officer, both of whom are hugely impressive, by the way, and their deputies, fantastic. I mean, really done their professions great pride, I think. They themselves would indicate that when you do things, how you do things, what you respond to needs to be considered. And therefore, it annoys me when things like the closure of the schools happened very much because of circumstances like teachers not turning up and, you know, there being a sort of concern amongst parents rather than actually a cool head. So, you know, you get to a point where you think, how much of this has been dictated by evidence, and what do you do about the fact that there's lots of rows amongst experts? It isn't straightforward that if anyone knew exactly what to do, then we'd be fine. So I at least want to have an eye to alternative views, not in the sense of go out and flout the lockdown, and that would be a sign of immaturity in my view. But on the other hand, I want to be open-minded about those people who are suggesting that there is a longer term cost, and that even the medical experts themselves know that the toll on people's real health of locking down society and the longer term toll in terms of not economic futures based on just whether somebody's making a profit, but the fact that people's lives will be utterly devastated by their inability to ever earn any money, ever. These things do have to be part of the mix of the discussion.
Definitely. And I think that point you make about, you know, is this a political decision or is it one that's led by the evidence is very well made, because it does feel like at the moment, particularly the media response, as you say, that it feels like up until the announcement of the lockdown and since, the only legitimate line of criticism is, when are we going to lock down quicker, faster, more severely? You know, when are we going to go the full extent of somewhere like France or somewhere like Italy? And it seems like almost any other kind of raising of considerations around could be the economy, or it could even just be, you know, the effectiveness of this lockdown to flattening the curve of infections and deaths is almost seen as some sort of frippery that isn't, you know, it's not for now to discuss. But Chris, on that point, do you fear that some of these measures have been moved into too quickly? Is it just a case that we need to wait and see at this point? What are your thoughts?
I think in a couple of cases, maybe they were brought forward a tiny bit, but I mean, we're talking a matter of a day or two, really. And in a case like this, you're on the side of caution. I mean, the health case, at least, for keeping the schools open, keeping the pubs open, was that we effectively want more people to get this because we want a certain level of herd immunity for the second wave in winter. But there's a lot of ifs and buts about that. And if you misjudge the timing of these closures, even by a few days, you could have a serious crisis on your hands, and we don't know how the curve's going to go up. So you can understand people wanting to bring about those closures a day or two earlier, at least. It's a very, very difficult decision for people to make. And the whole issue of herd immunity is extremely controversial anyway. It's not obvious to me as a kind of armchair epidemiologist that if 15, 20% of the population get the coronavirus, which would seem to be on the top end of what we're looking at, that it's going to have any significant effect in preventing a second wave. So I don't know. And so again, I kind of defer to the experts on this one.
Just on that though, well, first of all, I'm not arguing this from the point of view of the position of herd immunity. I mean, it was convincing when it was said to me, but like you, Chris, I mean, you know, the idea that I'm going to say herd immunity, that's the way forward, I'm convinced. I'm certainly not arguing that. I was actually making a slightly different point about the schools, which was when you looked at what the decisions were going on in the background, there was sort of more a situation where many teachers were self-isolating at home. I mean, I didn't think they were being kept open so that everyone would catch it. They were actually being kept open as places where you could allow certain people to carry on working before they had the lockdown, if you remember. And the reason why they ended up closing down was much more pressure to close them down. That's what I'm saying, that there was political, just not medical. That was my only point on that. One of the things that we might talk about, because it reflects, or it's an important thing, I think, in terms of this, your podcast that you've been running for so long, is, I mean, I think this lockdown, such as it is, initially, certainly in the first couple of days, has been treated as though it's a kind of lockdown by consent with a vague bit of threat in the background. You know, this is the rules, stay at home. And I think that's pretty good. Because one of the things that my big dread is that just in the way that we won't be able to get used to sort of hugging each other or shaking hands in a few months' time because we won't remember what it is, that you end up in a situation where you become almost dependent on the idea that the state will do everything, you know, that we're waiting for the government to tell us what to do, and that you kind of lose a sense of responsibility. And that's kind of like, why doesn't the government pay me my wages? Why doesn't the government do this? Why don't, you know, everything is like, I want you to do this. And to a certain extent, those of us who believe in agency need to be cautious of that. But the other thing is that there's a slight, that threat can then be interpreted. You know what it's like? The government might be doing its best to make this a kind of lockdown by consent, but guess what? You know, Derbyshire and Yorkshire police are out waving down cars, asking them what is a necessary journey. Apparently, there's police stopping people in some shopping precincts in the northwest saying, is that necessary purchases that you're buying? Some of these things might be like urban myths, but the police stopping the cars isn't. And they're also threatening to fine people. And then you're basically handing powers to the police. Now, I'm not suggesting that Boris Johnson's setting up a police state. I know that Owen Jones has welcomed a police state. Most people don't, and even the police don't. But what I do think is that what we have to be careful of is that we don't just, in fear, because we're very worried about the virus and the overwhelming of the NHS, which I think is a very compelling argument for why we have to have the lockdown, and myself, the numbers of people who might die of the NHS collapses of other diseases and other illnesses. I don't think that we should just sit back and say, oh yes, well, the police are just enforcing the lockdown. All is well with me. Carry on, everyone. And the government's going to look after us, because I'm not prepared to give away that much autonomy in this compromised situation.
And we definitely got a glimpse today as we're recording of, as you say, Claire, the kind of potential excesses of all of this, particularly with that, I think it was Derbyshire Police who put out that video of drone footage over the countryside, you know, pointing out that the cars that were parked for people who were going to go on a walk were there unnecessarily. And that was a very kind of almost absurdly kind of Orwellian vision there. Chris, I was wondering if we could just move things on for a second to, I guess, the kind of way in which people are kind of using this crisis to push their own agendas. I know this is something that you've been flagging up on Twitter and on your blog. I've even noticed that some kind of, you know, we're talking about this as a genuine public health crisis as distinct from the sort of nanny state stuff, but even some of the nanny statists are trying to use this to talk about tobacco, to talk about e-cigarettes. Do you want to talk a little bit about that for a sec?
Yeah, it's really appalling. It's particularly bad in America, where this genuine epidemic has followed the fake vaping epidemic. And they are trying to, or certain people are trying to, use the lockdowns as an excuse to ban the sale of tobacco and e-cigarettes on the back of one study, very, very small study, which showed in China that a handful, I think five smokers in this study, that were more likely to die from coronavirus than the non-smokers were. Actually, if you look at the other studies, it's exactly the other way around. For some reason, there's the disproportionately no number of smokers in the coronavirus deaths in China. Now, I would never obviously claim that that's because smoking prevents coronavirus, but on the back of one study showing the opposite, people in New York are being told that they need to put up with prohibition of tobacco products. And tobacco products in America, because of the Weasley way that they define it, includes e-cigarettes. I've seen a public health director in this country, up in Sheffield, suggesting on Twitter that this would be a good time to ban the sale of tobacco because we know how bad it is and so on. So these guys can sniff the authoritarianism in the air, and they really kind of like it. And they're thinking, well, maybe this is the time to piggyback some of our own little obsessions, because we've got nothing else to do. Most of these public health people wouldn't know one end of a microscope from another. They're absolutely no use to man the beast during a pandemic. So what can they do other than just keep on going on about what they've been going on about for years and hope that they can slip a bit more authoritarianism into the mix in the midst of a crisis?
I was really shocked the other day when Sophie Gaston, who's a former deputy director of Demos and now a very well-respected public intellectual, she and I don't agree on lots of things, but I've always thought she was entirely sensible and level-headed and fair-minded, you know, a Remainer who I could always argue and discuss with, never hysterical. And she put on Twitter, you know, this is a serious respiratory virus. Why aren't the government stopping people smoking? Right. And quite a few comments underneath were, because we're under enough stress as it is, but that would really kill us off. But what I realized was that was just kind of, I'm sure she just did a kind of instinctive, she's not even a public health person. It was just that sort of like, people can't breathe and smokers need respirators and they're going to kind of clog the system. It was that, and there's a real danger there, isn't there, that some of those public health preoccupations kind of come to the fore in the panicky way that people are worried about who gets preference and who gets chosen. So I thought that was interesting. I also noticed today, I think it was George Parker from the FT, but I'm just not sure now, at the press conference, said, asked the deputy medical officer whether, who's been fantastic, by the way, that woman, Jenny Harris, said, are you worried about some of the public health consequences of the lockdown? This is after the media demanding the lockdown, because then we're going to have more obesity and more alcoholism as shells. And I thought she kind of handled it rather coolly. What I think is really funny is people can kind of bring up these prejudices, but at this stage, you just think, God, if you're drinking a bottle of wine a day, who cares, right? Got to get rid of the virus. Do you know what I mean? But you can see that these kind of preoccupations come in. So that's one thing. Mm. Just on the hijacking of it politically, though, on the one hand, I think that, I mean, I'm not alone in being outraged by the way that a wide variety of environmentalists have queued up to say this is nature's revenge. Humans were always the virus. You know, one of them has been accused of being a fake account that went out from Extinction Rebellion, but then you didn't really need a fake account to have two Guardian articles more or less saying the same thing, if slightly more subtly, including George Monbiot. But you basically get this sense in which people will interpret this through the prism that they've previously seen the world, and there are lots of misanthropic anti-humanists around the green movement, and they will see it in a particular way. I myself think that we also have to be wary of being clunky about our previous things. That's why, Chris, it's really interesting. You're right, you know, we're the anti-nanny staters, but it's not like you kind of go, this is the nanny state imposing itself, you know. But you don't also want to lose sight of some of the insights that we've all gained over how the state operates, how people operate. So I'm trying to balance those two things. I don't want to sound like I'm doing a knee-jerk, you know, Claire Fox yet again libertarian demands that we're all free, but on the other hand, I do believe in freedom. And those people who say to me, so you think that people should die just because of your stupid civil liberties concerns? Well, I don't think they're stupid civil liberties concerns. I'm not advocating people flout the lockdown, but I'm not prepared to give up on some of my long-held obsessions. Now, whether that's hijacking, I mean, it's more that I don't want to be able to, I don't want to be silenced as a dissenter if I want to raise some queries about now what is the, you have to do this behavior, because I think that would be a dangerous outcome too.
And there's plenty to talk about as well in relation to that with the coronavirus bill and the emergency powers they're in passing this week. You know, not really much opposition to that. The kinds of provisions in there as far as police and immigration officials and others being able to detain people if they suspect they have symptoms of the coronavirus, you know, loosening some of the safeguards around surveillance. There's a lot of really serious stuff here. Chris, you might want to talk to some of that, but I was also wondering, you know, we've talked a lot about how useless a lot of the public health establishment has been, how given to panic over things that didn't turn out to be as threatening. You know, it's interesting that we're talking so much about the chief medical officer when, you know, up until quite recently, it was Dame Sally Davies talking about people should think of cancer before they have a glass of wine. Mm. So I guess, is there a kind of case that we've been slightly underprepared for a crisis such as this because there has been this obsession with those trivialities, with lifestyle rather than, you know, these kinds of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, isn't it interesting that no one's seen hide nor hair of Duncan Selby, the guy who runs Public Health England, who's on about £250,000 a year. He is never there flanking Boris. It's always witty and Vance. You would think this would be his moment. You know, £4 billion a year is spent on Public Health England, and we have a public health crisis. Where are Public Health England? They're just retweeting tweets from the Department for Health. And if you look at what Public Health England spends its money on, okay, most of it goes to the local authorities. More than $3 billion goes to local authorities. But those guys have virtually nothing to do with virology or vaccines or you know, stockpiling face masks and stuff. The Public Health England itself spends a bit of money on contagious diseases, but like something like £100 million out of a £4 billion budget. And I think that's gone down over the years. I think we used to spend more on that. Now, I'm not suggesting we spend £4 billion a year preparing for pandemics, obviously. Infectious diseases are, generally speaking, not a big problem in Western countries. I've said for years that it's morally obscene to be spending so much money on nanny state stuff in this country and abroad. If you remember the podcast we did talking about the incredible amount of money wasted from the foreign aid budget on tackling secondhand smoke in Bangladesh and too much salt being consumed in China. Morally disgusting, I think, to be spending that kind of money when there are still infectious diseases running rampant in those parts of the world. But also, we should be prepared for a pandemic. You know, it's not a complete black swan to have a viral pandemic. We've been warned about them for years. None of them really came to anything except this one. So I'm not expecting Public Health England to have a ready-made vaccine for coronavirus. Of course not. But you would think there would be a stockpile of face masks, which are pretty cheap, maybe some hazmats, maybe ample ventilators. We're not talking enormous amounts of money considering we're spending £4 billion a year on public health. But we're not doing any of that. We're spending huge amounts of money, mainly pestering people about their diet and about their smoking and about their drinking. And so, yeah, I think Public Health England should be held responsible for our lack of preparation for this. They would probably say, look, it's not our job to have face masks and ventilators. Well, that kind of proves my point. Why do we have Public Health England if they're not, you know, responsible for those kind of things? The job of tackling this has fallen entirely to the Department of Health. Public Health England has almost nothing to do with it.
I think that as well, that initial point that I made, quoting Matt Ridley, was very important in terms of how seriously people took this at the beginning. Because I do think that if you're told by public health officials that if you eat bacon, you're going to die of cancer, or if you drink wine, if you're pregnant, this is going to lead to alcoholism for your child and all the rest of it, all these kind of, and this complete language of scaremongering that's gone on. When then somebody says this is a public health crisis, it's very odd to know whether it's a public health crisis. And I don't just mean myself. I mean, I think people just were a bit like, what's all that going on? You know what I mean? Because they've also kind of compromised the language of catastrophe. Yeah. By overusing it, just the way I would make the same point about the way people bandy around using the word fascism, by the way. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Or racist. The other thing that really strikes me is certainly Public Health England don't appear to me to have done any use to anyone for years, apart from over-regulating our lives. But one of the things that I do think is that I hope one of the things that will come out of this is a greater respect for the pharmaceutical, not just the industry, but, you know, the medical interventions that one might need. The research, the labs, all these kind of things to deal with diseases, real medical problems in preference to made up ones. Because one of the reasons it strikes me that the testing is causing such difficulty is that there aren't enough labs that are working on this. If you actually look at the regulations that have held back people from really experimenting and doing work on this. They are political regulations, the precautionary principle in terms of that aspect of things, all sorts of rules in terms of what chemicals you can use, by the way, which also affect the testing. And there's quite interestingly lots of restrictions. Those restrictions have now been torn up and thrown out because you're prepared to do anything to solve this problem. So I hope that we might actually get rid of some of those things that have held back medical innovation and intervention. And the final bit just on the Public Health England side and why they're so irrelevant now, which I think that they might have just, you know, they really might be never able to reemerge again in quite the same way, is that you, Chris, of all people, really importantly, have always made the point that none of us were against real public health interventions. But what called themselves public health interventions were explicitly politically about shaping the behaviour of individuals according to a model citizen. And at least now we can contrast that with this. It's not that I wanted this to happen in order to discredit them. I just mean it will be very hard for them to get away with it, which is one of the reasons why I don't want just us to accept behavioural norms as a permanent matter in how we react to this. We have to constantly say, this is temporary. We're prepared to hand over our liberty and to let you tell us how to behave for now, but it's only for now and it's not in the long term.
Absolutely right. You know,
can I ask you something, Chris? Because one of the things is, I do think that we can't let the state do everything, because I'm worried about how I want to be able to encourage people to use their judgment. And we've always said that people should be free to make their own mistakes. When I say we, I mean, that's kind of like, if you want to make a choice that might risk your health, now this is different because you'll be risking somebody else's if you break the rules. But I do think that we want to encourage people to use their judgment in this, don't you? That's why it can't be too much of a lockdown, or there has to be some sense in which people can say, I think it's worth me going out to see Mrs. Smith with them. You know, some box of food. I'm making a calculated risk. I'll go and visit my daughter because she's pregnant, and I've decided, you know, there's got to be some flexibility here. Otherwise, we will never get away with being able to argue that people can make those decisions on their own. It's almost like we might lose the habit.
Yeah, well, we've been kind of told to get out of the habit for so long, haven't we? And I think one of the reasons so many people have found the last few weeks so disorientating is because they just assume that the government can fix everything, and the government can't fix this. There isn't a fix. Yeah, it can bring a lockdown about, but it's not going to stop a second wave. Most of us are probably going to get this thing sooner or later. And that probably lies behind all the demands for the government must do this, government must do that. In regards to the coronavirus bill and the huge sacrifices of civil liberties that we're putting up with at the moment, I don't believe that any of the MPs intend to keep this stuff in the long term. The battle will be in a couple of years when the public health people, in particular, other people as well, the environmentalists, start looking at the data from this period. The environmentalists, for example, will say, wow, look how much greenhouse gas emissions fell by. Maybe there are lessons to be learned from this. Maybe we don't bring out, you know, we don't have a full lockdown, but maybe we could take elements of that to try and curb our greenhouse gas emissions. I can imagine there'll probably be a fall in crime at the moment if you don't include people walking along the Peak District. I think it seems plausible to me there will be a drop in burglaries, for example. What lessons should we take from that? You know, so authoritarians have a habit of looking at some of the worst times in history and taking inspiration from it. You know, the Second World War and rationing, I've often heard public health people say what a golden age that was. Similarly, there was a study a few years ago about the huge recession that Cuba experienced just after the Soviet Union collapsed and they stopped getting money from Russia. And there was, surprise, surprise, there was a big drop in obesity. And this is considered to be quite an encouraging thing. You know, so I think we'll see quite a few studies like that. This is an enormous and very interesting natural experiment. And I fear some people are going to, you know, learn the wrong lessons from it.
Just finally, just to try and end it on a bit of a positive note. I mean, I thought it was striking today, Claire, that in the space of 24 hours, you know, there was, half a million people signing up to volunteer for the NHS to help there. That's kind of with the backdrop of a lot of kind of sniping and a lot of kind of, you know, Twitter shaming of people who are seen to not be following the rules quite to the letter or quite to how much certain journalists would like them to. What's your kind of sense of the kind of public response to this so far? Because it does feel like people are taking it a lot more seriously and with a sense of their own responsibilities than a lot of people in the press would have us believe at this point.
Absolutely. I think there's a real danger that people imagine that COVID idiots are the norm rather than a very small group of people. And then once you've got established this notion of the COVIDiot, you then start to see everything through the prism of they're all idiots. You know, why are there so many people going for a walk when in fact they're trying to take their exercise? You know, it's like, why can't people go in the garden? Well, not everyone's got one. And why are the tubes full? I mean, apart from the ridiculous way that the mayor cut the numbers, therefore there was more people. But there's also a lot of key workers, and that's why they were out. So I think that we want to get away from that kind of name and shame. I mean, I just don't feel that that's the norm at all. You know, maybe because I've got so many people around the Brexit, you know, a lot of Brexit party activists, or not party activists, it's not in Brexit party, but a lot of people in the Northwest now follow me, or I kind of know them and so on and so forth. A lot of people who voted Leave see this as an opportunity to prove that they are stand-up citizens, you know, who are capable of being treated like grown-ups by the government and can take decisions, you know what I mean? And they're being responsible and staying in, and then being very community-minded as well. And that's very positive. I also think it's great that so many people signed up for the NHS volunteers, but I've genuinely been impressed by the local initiatives that have just been set up by people on their streets and dropping food parcels off and visiting people and phoning people up. Somebody told a very funny story that she went around and dropped in notes to all the over 70-year-olds saying if they wanted anything from the shops on her street. And they all dropped in notes to her, who's much younger, saying, thank you very much, sir. It's very kind of you. By the way, if you want me to go and get you anything, or if you get ill, I'll help out. It's kind of like, it's sort of like the elderly helping everyone, you know. So that's generally been a very positive aspect to it. I suppose what we need to see, and what will keep us going, is in a period where we're being asked to physically be antisocial, to avoid each other, we need to keep alive a sense of social solidarity. And that we're all human, and that we're all looking out for each other. And even if looking out for each other means avoiding each other on the pavement and walking away from each other, we do so with a smile and a nod, because we're doing that because we want to get through this. And the final positive thing I'd say is, because I'm a bit romantic about these things, I'm delighted that one of the things that's come through on this is that a lot of people who've never really understood the way society works have suddenly noticed that there's a whole range of people who keep society going that don't often get credit. And I'm not suggesting they all get wage rises, or that might be very nice, and there'd be no wages for anyone at this rate. But I do think that at last people have noticed that if you work in a care home, you might be doing something useful. That actually, if you're the person who has to pick up the rubbish every week, and if you're a cleaner, if you're working in a factory producing food, processing food, you're working in an abattoir, that these people are keeping things going, and that they are not always sung as heroes. And people are beginning to think, God, those lads who are stacking the shelves in Tesco's might have a bit more about them than treating them like the dirt under my shoe. And the reason why that's important is because we've had a full whack on Project Fear over the last few years about the impact of what would happen in terms of leaving the EU. We've also had a very unpleasant and unhappy, utter disdain shown to ordinary people who happen to vote the wrong way, according to certain people in society. So it's nice to have a little bit of balancing where people suddenly look at each other and think, oh, do you know what? Those people are doing a bloody good job, those office cleaners, those people that don't always get attention. And I'm hoping, I see a lot more of that, and I really like it.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.